This is Dylan FM, the podcast that goes deep into the work and world of Bob Dylan. If you love Dylan, you're in the right place with your host, Craig Danieloff.
The 80s were a rough decade for Bob Dylan, as we know, especially as they were thought of at the time. But there was one undisputed bright spot: his participation in the Traveling Wilburys. And that's what we're talking about today with our guest, Jeff Slate. As we've talked about in this series, the time we're calling Bob Dylan's five worst years, 1984 through 1988, not a lot felt right. Not a lot was in sync with the times. Not a lot was immediately recognized and successful. To fans, and maybe even to Dylan, it felt a lot like the line found in Infidels.
Yesterday is just a memory. Tomorrow's never what it's supposed to be.
But in early 1988, Dylan finally caught a break. A few weeks after being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and just days before setting out to begin the never-ending tour, he and some friends had some fun and made some music. You probably know the story of George Harrison having dinner with Jeff Lynne and Roy Orbison, needing to cut a B-side the next day, picking up his guitar at Tom Petty's house, and asking Dylan to borrow his studio. The result was Handle With Care. It was too good to be a B-side, and so they decided to make a whole album.
Everybody's got somebody to lean on. Put your body next to mine.
The results went double platinum. The press was in adulation mode. Everyone loved it, hardcore fans and FM rock radio listeners. It was the best press Bob Dylan had enjoyed since the Blood on the Tracks, Desire, and Rolling Thunder period over a decade before. Our guest today is the perfect person to discuss this all with. Jeff Slate is a musician and a music writer, a major Bobaholic and extreme Wilburys fan, and someone who has talked about all this stuff with Tom Petty, Jeff Lynne, and he co-authored Roy Orbison's biography with the help and blessing of his family. Jeff has been a guest here before. He talked to us about Time Out of Mind and the day he skipped work to listen to that new release. He wrote the liner notes for the Blood on the Tracks bootleg series, interviewed Roger McGuinn at the first World of Bob Dylan, and so much more. And he's got a brand new album that's about to drop. You'll hear a little bit of one song just before the intro, and I'll put the whole song at the end of our discussion. There are links to Jeff's website where you can order the new LP and to his music on Spotify and Apple in the show notes.
When winter comes, you will move on. When winter comes, you will move on.
There's no extended edition of this episode. The whole show is here in the public feed. But please consider becoming an FM Plus subscriber to access over 100 other extended and bonus Bob Dylan shows from Dylan FM and Pod Dylan, The Dylan Taunts, and our newest show, Infinity Goes Up on Trial. It's just $5 a month, and that fee helps us make these shows. It buys you tons of old and upcoming exclusive Dylan content. We don't have any ads, we put out a lot of stuff, and we'd really appreciate your support. Sign up in Apple Podcasts or at fmpods.com. And if you want to go further, you can become an FM Premium member. That gets you video versions of most of our shows, including this one, a bonus copy of our weekly newsletter that covers everything that happens in the world of Bob Dylan, bonus posts from Substack, access to a private website full of Dylan research data, and more. Find out how to become an FM Premium member in the show notes. But now, let's listen to a little bit of Jeff Slate's new song, Till New York City Dies, from his upcoming record, The Last Day of Summer. And then he'll tell us the secrets of the Traveling Wilburys.
I'm gonna love you till New York City dies. I'm gonna love you under New York City skies.
No, Jeff Slate, thanks for joining us again to visit the middle years. If I don't know if chronologically that's right, but we're talking about 84, 85.
Early middle.
86, 87, 88. Yeah, well, I guess if Bob names things, this can be the late, early, whatever. And this happens to coincide with a bunch of Bob's big events, our partners and other musicians that you've spent a lot of time with. So I wanted to talk to you today about the Wilburys. You have lots of history there. About Petty a little bit is another guy you know a lot about. And just generally what you think of this time period in Bob's life. But thanks for talking again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Pleasure to be here.
And you have a brand new album, which we'll mention and play a little of so people can get a taste of that as well.
Thank you.
So the centerpiece of what we plan to talk about, and I think we'll go past it, is the Wilburys, which are the very end of this, you know.
Yeah.
Although actually I was looking last night at the stuff, and I know the main album was recorded in May of 88 and it came out later, but they, in the movie they make a point that the Handle With Care song was sometime before that. I couldn't really find April. When that was.
I can tell you, I'll tell you a really interesting story just to put in perspective how creative these guys were at that moment. So the first week of April, after, you know, Jeff, Lynn and Tom Petty sort of run into each other on Thanksgiving Day, and Tom's going to buy baseball mitts and he's listening to Cloud Nine, and, you know, everybody knows the story. I'll be like McCartney, tell the same story over and over. But they hook up and they're making Full Moon Fever. And in a 5-day stretch, they wrote and recorded Free Fallin', I Won't Back Down, You're So Bad, You Got It, took a day off, and then recorded Handle With Care. That's what was going on the first week of April 1988, for those two guys, right?
Yeah. Yeah. The whole story.
And three, if you include Roy, you know, and I only figured that out. I don't think anybody had figured that out when we were doing the, you know, I wrote the book, The Authorized Roy Orbison, with his sons. So I had his whole archive. I literally had like his entire archive of, you know, every advertisement and piece of paper. It was a crazy amount of stuff that they had collected. His mom had collected. This guy who's just an Uber fan took it on himself to build an archive. So they had this amazing repository. When I started to, I'm like, oh, okay, you know, well, I knew that Free Fallin' and Won't Back Down happened here. And then I knew You Got It happened here. And then I was like, wait a minute. But Handle With Care was on April, I think it's the 5th. Maybe it was the 8th, I think. Yeah, April 8th. That's all in a 1-week period. That's crazy. You know, and they were doing other stuff. I mean, they were tracking Tom's album in Mike Campbell's garage. So like they were on, that's for any musician to have written those 5 songs. That's a career, right? You could spread that out over 10 or 20 or 30 years. To do it in like a 1-week period, it blows my mind. And to have it, you know, those are songs that, you know, I play. We just did a show. We did a Wilbury show recently at Beetlefest here at the TWA Hotel out at JFK. And so, you know, we did a Wilbury set. But, you know, to do a Wilbury set, you don't want to just play the album stuff. We did You Got It and Free Fallin' and Won't Back Down, you know, all the big songs. And You Ain't Going Nowhere, which doesn't fit at all, but I like playing it and crowds love it. So, and when you play those songs, it's like everybody knows them. They know every word. They love them. They get excited because they don't get to hear, you know, particularly Beatle fans, they don't get to hear You Got It. And, you know, George sang backing vocals on it. So it's very exciting we played This Is Love because it's sort of also Wilbury's adjacent. And, you know, those are songs people don't get to hear. And yet they're perfect pop songs, you know, from that period, you know, music in the 80s, you know, I hated it then. I hate it now. I know people, there are people who really love that area. There are very few albums that I like from that era. And you know, not a lot of great, there was some great songwriting, but the production, you know, is so sort of bad, which we'll get to. But those songs, even with the sort of Jeff Lynne sound that, you know, love it or hate it, those songs rise above. They're just perfect. So,
yeah, well, that's incredible. It's funny because Harrison tells the story that they recorded Handle With Care, and then he literally says, I just had it in my pocket for a long time. It sounds like it was 3 weeks, but I guess in his life, 3 weeks is a long time. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think these guys tell these stories in retrospect. Some of it's that, some of it's, it just wasn't what he was doing at that moment. And, you know, you got to understand when they say they recorded it, my understanding is that the original version of Handle With Care that they played to Mo Austin was just a like boom, tap, boom, boom, tap, old 80s drum machine. It didn't have any proper tracking on it. It just had their voices and the rhythm guitars and a little bit of guitar. I don't think it had the slide or harmonica or any of that.
Oh.
So it might have had the harmonica, actually. And they took that to Mo Austin, who was like, oh, my God, you got to finish this and you got to make it, you know. So I don't think they had added everything, because they then took everything back to his studio. Yeah. And made it a record, you know, they sort of, and we can get into how they did it and how they carved it out of Bob's schedule and all that. I mean, I'm a repository of Wilbury's information, but you might not want to get that down in the weeds. People can DM me at all.
Yeah, the Wilbury's is a miracle and it's just fantastic. I think it's weird how it gets treated relative to Bob's catalog, because it's in this time period that people don't think highly of, and yet everybody loves it. It is just, you know, so fun and infectious, and there's not a thing to not like about it, audio or video or the story or whatever. And Bob has a big role, right? It's not like Bob, you know, is floating in the periphery of this thing. There's two songs that are kind of his. Seems like he probably had a lot to do with, you know, even the more funny ones seem like they're a lot of Dylan, you know, besides the Jersey girl thing. So the idea that, you know, they wanted to use Bob's studio and Bob was hanging around and got involved. And then despite his schedule, because there's a tour coming, and then I think Down in the Groove scheduling is in here somewhere as well. You know, he signed up for the project. So just in terms of where Bob was and Bob's openness to it, what is there anything you, any insight you have in that? Or what do you think about that, that, you know, Bob is, I mean, for me and for this series, right, Bob's coming through this period of Burlesque and Down in the Groove and the Dead, and he'd already been on the road with Petty, obviously. So kind of the story people are attaching to it is Bob's attaching to other people to find something, to get a mix. And then this thing comes out, which is the four best guys. And it turns out to produce something that the world loves, which in terms of charts probably is a higher number than Bob had been at in a while.
Mm-hmm.
How do you see this little episode sitting in the Dylan story?
I mean, I've certainly done a ton of research on this, but I did ask Tom Petty about it. And I think his impression was they all, particularly George and Bob, they wanted to be in a band with Roy Orbison. The big thing for them was Roy. Mm-hmm. And you know, I get that. It's like if I got to be in a band with Tom, it would be like that would be the biggest deal in the world. So for these guys, Roy was the previous generation, was sort of their first benchmark of stardom. And he created, you know, a lot of what we think of Bob creating as the rock star in 65, 66 with the black and the great suits and the shades and the whole, it's Roy. I mean, Roy did it first, you know? So there's clearly a lot of love for him. And then I think, you know, these are guys who, there's no contrivance here. I mean, you know, these are just guys who hung around each other anyway. And, you know, I don't think, I know that certainly Tom and George were very close at the time and became closer with Jeff later. And George and Jeff were very close. Jeff was working with Roy, and they were all enamored with Roy because he was funny and, you know, the whole thing. But, you know, I think only George Harrison could make this happen. He tells a story like, oh, well, I knew Bob had a studio. It was a Sunday, and I knew we couldn't get a studio. So I just called Bob, and he said, yes, come on over. George is the only guy who could make that happen. You know, nobody else calls Bob and says, hey, can we come? I've got a bunch of guys. We're going to come over and have a barbecue. We're going to write a song. I got to write this C side. And by the way, I'm going to get you to help and co-write, and then we're going to make a band out of it. I mean, that would only snowball into existence if it was either Bob, that's not his thing, or George, who really, really, really wanted to be in a band. And I think if you've been in a band with John and Paul, where do you go from there? You know, it's right. Fine. No disrespect to even Roy, but Jeff and Tom, you want to be in a band with Bob. He's your, you know, he's been your guiding light since Free Will, right?
Right.
So I think Bob loved, by all accounts, George very much. They got along well. In a way, I think he probably couldn't with any other musician because of George's experience. Who? Muhammad Ali? You know, who lived that kind of mania and people picking through your garbage and all, you know, all the crazy stuff they had to live through.
Plus, as an artist, right? I mean, besides that stuff, right? The respect is like, okay, he's that good. He was that, you know, popular and famous.
He was that guy. I think in that group of guys, that goes without saying. I mean, they're hanging out because they feel like peers. But hanging out and making a record with friends, that's a different thing. My guess is if it was all those guys, well, maybe if Roy was in it, Bob would have said yes, but who would have asked him? Nobody would have had the, I asked Petty, I was like, because I wanted to know what Bob is like, as we all do. And we were just chit chatting at an event. And I was like, you know, what's Bob like? And he's really funny. And, you know, we went off. And I said to him at one point, because he was talking about him like in a very abstract way, you know? And I was like, but, you know, you've toured with him. You've known him now for 30 years. You know, you're friends with Bob, right? And he's like, I don't know. Right? And I thought that was really interesting. They traveled the world two times over. You know, they were in the Wilburys together. They'd done other shows together. Their paths have crossed. You know, they've been to each other's houses and their families are friends. And it's like, and he had to like think about it. I thought, that's insane. Like, he's not really sure where he sits in Bob's life. I thought that was fascinating. So I think anybody else who would have asked that question, peer group or not, it had to be George because he liked him and he liked the vibe of the guys. That's, you know, Bob is a vibe guy.
Yeah. And watching that video, I mean, all the great tape of, and I didn't realize till last night that it was Dave Stewart's house they were at,
yeah,
which is cool.
Yeah. Did I tell you that in our pre?
No. They mentioned it in the movie. And you know, I knew that there was a house. I don't know. Just maybe I knew 20 years ago, but that's just another cool fact. But there's all that video, and you know, as like you, someone who's watched all the Bob stuff, to see Bob, you know, sitting around in the kitchen playing guitar with, it has to be those guys. And then the candids, if you will, of the audio recording process, just for Bob to allow, you know. And sometimes it does seem like with the commentary that George was holding the camera. So
George, those are George's videos. My understanding is 90% of those are George's videos. I love that shot in the kitchen because Bob is playing like a heavy metal bass. He's not even playing guitar. He's playing like a weird kind of Kramer bass, totally bizarre. But I just love, you know, I just think those are guys who wanted to hang out together and they all happened to not be doing anything at that very moment and carved out a week, 10 days.
Yeah.
And that's what we got.
How do you think about the songs that obviously came as a group and they'd show that directly, but Bob's contribution and what do you think it freed up for Bob to do that, you know, back in the Knocked Out Loaded studio or, you know, these where he was in his career wasn't happening?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, he'd worked with Petty before and to mixed results, certainly. We all have tracks we like from that. I love Band of the Hand. I wrote about it in the Mixing Up the Medicine. But the 80s were a weird time for that generation of artists. It's not, we single out Bob because he's Bob Dylan. But if you think about it, all those guys, McCartney, George,
Neil,
all of them, they're now in their 40s. They're nearing 50. you know, the Stones are trying to make dance records. McCartney's fiddling around with Fairlights and drum machines and, you know, Townsend too. They're all trying to find their place in a, what was still very much a young person's game, right? There were no elder statesmen then. There were pop stars. And they were sort of hanging on to the last shreds of pop stardom. Their records would still get written about. Jan Wenner was still their friend. They'd still make the cover of Rolling Stone. And it would translate occasionally into good records and good coverage and sales and so forth. But I think artistically, if you look at that period, it's not that there's no good songs. It's that they were trying to make hit records. They were trying to make records that sounded of that moment, right? You know, he wasn't working with random producers at that time. He worked with, you know, Sly and Robbie, and, you know, it's this weird mixture of, it's not desperation, but it's like there's an expectation because of who you are that you should still be able to capture that magic, you know? And I think one of the things those guys hadn't realized yet, which Bob talks about in the 60 Minutes interview with Ed Bradley, is, you know, I was that guy then, but I'm not that guy now. I can do other things now, but I can't do that. I think at that time, they hadn't quite grasped that, because everybody around them is like, well, just do this again, you know, or just, it's going to be top 20. We'd like it to be top 10, but it should really be top 5. And McCartney was really, you know, he's a competitive guy. Yeah, I don't think Bob was in that category, but I do think he was reaching for something that is sort of magic. You know, it's elusive. Here's a great example. So the first time I saw Bob was with the Heartbreakers, and it was in 1986. And many people have heard this story, but I'm going to tell it again. When the tickets went on sale, I was in college. I didn't have money for the tickets, so I ended up having to scalp 2 tickets. And the show was in the middle of summer, so not many of my college friends were around. But everybody asked, were like, eh. You know, because Bob was like, you know, he was seen as kind of, well, his shows are kind of spotty, and he's, you know, he doesn't play his hits, and I don't know. It just come out of the gospel period for most people. And Empire Burlesque was like, you know, it had some videos on MTV, but it wasn't, but remarkable now to think about it, but people were like, eh, about Tom. It was post-Southern Accents and Long After Dark, which in retrospect are pretty great records. But at the time, people were like, oh yeah, I like that, Don't Come Around Here No More, but eh. You know, it's just crazy to me, right? So I couldn't get anybody to go with me to see Tom Petty and Bob Dylan. I scalped the ticket, and the guy who I ended up sitting with was this, I think he was a Vietnam vet, and he'd seen, the last time he'd seen Bob was with the band at the Garden. So he was like the whole time telling me stories, like, oh man, what are you? And it was great. It was like director's commentary. But it was weird to me because nobody of my generation wanted to see them. So that just sort of illustrates the point that they were in this kind of no man's land, both creatively and as cultural people. I mean, George, the way he captured that, because he'd made, you know, Gone Trope was a great record, but he just was like, he gave up after that because it was such a bomb. He got Jeff Lynne, who could make great pop records that sounded like Beatles records, and then proceeded to write Beatles songs, right? That's Cloud Nine. You can take issue with right. that, but the way for him to do that was to literally put on his, in the video, literally put on his Sgt. Pepper coat and do When We Was Fab and get Ringo in. And who's he going to get to play? Well, of course he gets his friends, but when people know it's Clapton and Elton, and I mean, you know, that's like, so I think George had the ability to do that. That just wasn't the way Bob thought. He was always thinking forward, not backward. So it's very hard for an artist like that to capture what 15 and 20 year olds are listening to when he's 40, 45. That's a long-winded answer to I think we could talk about that the whole podcast. You know, it's a really interesting period.
And it is really important, and I'm glad you went through it, to help people get back to what was happening then. Because, you know, we look at all this stuff, you know, 30, 40 years later, and things have been laid on top of it. And the only other thing to add to that atmosphere is to look at who was on top, you know, sort of young Prince. And you think, okay, what the hell does Dylan pull out of his, or you know, kind of wave two of Springsteen's going on then? And you kind of think, you know, yeah, what does Bob Dylan do?
You know, yeah, but you know, think about it this way. At the time we're talking about, certainly around the Wilburys, that was Bruce's LA period, Tunnel of Love and that, which I happen to, it's one of the few Bruce Springsteen records I love. But the fans hated that.
Yeah.
Because he was trying to do something different.
Later. I was talking like, you know, Born in the USA is 84.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah, okay, sure.
Yeah,
sure.
You're right. Springsteen, you know, but also his age, you know, it's a lot about that. You know, it's a lot about being 40 or 46 or whatever and going, it was Wesley Stace, I think, who's, you know, made a comment to me about the, what Bob's wearing on the cover of Empire Burlesque. And he's like, well, that's the last time that guy ever tried that.
you know, it's like, Yeah. Well, and it's funny because I think every musician goes through this period in their sort of late 30s and 40s, certainly musicians who play rock and roll, where you get a little bit lost. And then all of a sudden, after you sort of turn 50-ish, people start coming again to your shows and it becomes easy and everything is nice again. And I said this once to Paul Weller, who many people won't understand. I'm like, all of a sudden people are coming to the shows again. And he goes, you didn't die. You're just still here. They remembered from when the, you know, now they have a little bit of money and the kids are grown. And so they have free time again. But that whole period when nobody was coming to your shows, that was when you get like 100 people instead of 3. That's because people, or 50, you know, or less sometimes. It's because they were busy. You weren't doing anything interesting for them. And they're now it's a nostalgia thing. So
well, and like, they, I mean, different topic, but right then they're new in a job, kids that are 3 years old, right? They're distracted.
Yeah.
So
a
bunch of stuff happens.
Yeah.
Well, let's look specifically at the Dylan songs, right? So there's two that are the most obvious, right? Okay. Congratulations.
Yes.
And Tweeter and the Monkey Man that are almost like the other guys, just, you know, step back. Not songs. I haven't really played the game of which Dylan album would they go on, but it kind of would be hard. Congratulations is probably one, you know,
it's the only, I think it's the only one he's played.
Live. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. I remember him doing it maybe late 90s, 2000s. There's somewhere on YouTube or somewhere, you know, dial up Expecting Rain and we'll find it. But there's definitely, he did Congratulations, but I think that's the only Wilbury song he's ever played. Because it's his song. I mean, that was just in the batch of songs he had kind of lying around, and they only had a certain amount of time to do it, right? Tweeter and the Monkey Man was he and Tom, who knew each other well and were comfortable with each other and had written songs before. They'd done Jam and Me and like that, had written lyrics before, wanted to send up Bruce. And there's apparently video of them doing this, although we've never seen it, that Jeff Lynn told me, because any Wilbury I interview, I ask them about the Wilburys. I don't care about their current record. You know, he and George were just watching them do this. And it was just, they were like, I think there's 8 verses to Tweeter and the Monkey Man. We play it a lot. It's a lot. And he said it just went on and on. It was like even more that they got it down to that sort of perfect 8 or 7 or whatever it is. But again, Congratulations is a song. I don't know where it would fit in that time period of Bob Dylan. Like, I can see where it would fit maybe at different points in his career. And I guess we don't really know. We may never know when precisely it was written. It sounds to me like it came up then. And I think the story I heard is he was always a little sour grapes that he brought in some of those songs that he felt like he should have held back. Like maybe Congratulations belonged on a Bob record. Maybe it should have been done differently, you know, because it's very Jeff Lynne, which is, you know, that's the Wilburys. So
I looked it up. It was twice in the June of 89, England and Scotland. And then he pulled it out at Toad's Place.
Okay. Right. So I wasn't wrong, but I was, you know, I was pushing the, I thought it was more recent than that, but that makes sense. But anyway, Tweeter and the Monkey Man is a Wilbury song. He wouldn't have written that song with anybody else. He wouldn't have recorded that song with anybody else. That's his party piece for the Wilburys.
Well, a lot of the way I think about Bob on that album is the humor. It's stuff you think he wouldn't do. He might write or, you know, screw around in the studio, but he's not going to put out. But on that album, it felt right to have, you know, those jokes on the, you know, the co-writes with Petty and the,
sure,
you know, the, sure, the girl who's a broken down car, all these
not,
things.
Not so serious. Yeah.
Right. But it's fun to see Bob get to do that and enjoy it and obviously be great at it. And you can see the other guys, you know, in the video laughing their head off at him throwing these lines out.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, you know, people don't talk about, and I don't know if we're going to get to talk about Volume 3, which is the second Wilburys record.
Yeah.
You know, the interesting thing about that is obviously the part everybody knows is that, you know, Roy was dead. I mean, he died when the Wilburys were just taking off in December 88. And contrary to what everybody, and I've done tons of research into this, there was never any discussion about bringing anybody. There was never going to be a replacement. The way the rumor got started was, firstly, because Clapton and George are such good friends, and Ringo was in some videos with the guys. But they had called McGuinn to play a 12-string part on Volume 1, just to come in, do a session. We're making this record. And he was on the road and couldn't do it. So it was never like he was going to be a Wilbury. I mean, anybody who was at the talk that I did with him in Tulsa, I think we talked about that because it was one of those things like I like people to know these things because people create these stories about Bob or the Wilburys or George or, you know, whatever. And they become fact. But, you know, he wasn't ever going to be a Wilbury. Del Shannon wasn't going to be a Wilbury. Nobody wanted to work with Del Shannon. You know, I mean, he's a great guy and a huge talent, but he was a dark, dark guy. And both Petty and Lynn had trouble with them. Anyway, by the time they get to Volume 3, they can only find 1 week in Bob's schedule where the rest of them are all available. So they go into the studio and in 1 week make Volume 3. They don't do all the overdubs and, you know, drums and all that other stuff. Well, they did do drums live, but they did that all in 1 week. And my understanding is, and I couldn't find it in the archive out in Tulsa, but my understanding is that George and Jeff Lynne had Bob record all the vocals. Just do, because what they would do is they would each, and we can get into this if you want to, but they would each audition to sing the song. You know, and Tom told me how he was like sitting on the couch practicing whatever song it was. And Roy was next to him. He's like, I got nothing. You know, it's like, but so there probably exists somewhere or did at some point those Volume 3 songs with just Bob singing. And they're very Bob. You know, that Volume 3 is much more kind of that rootsy rock aggressive thing that Bob was doing at that point in the early 90s, live certainly. Anyway, that's a digression, but you can see why those songs have more of that humor and a little more Bob as the key vocalist in those songs, or the guy who kind of anchors the songs, because if you've got Bob Dylan singing the song and it sounds great, I mean, you can add Tom or George, but it's Bob Dylan. You know, a lot of what I'm talking about wasn't for publication. It was just, I happened to have conversations with Roy's kids a lot. So there's a lot of like backstage stuff that's really interesting, but also with Jeff Lynne and Tom, you know, they liked talking about the Wilburys. They have very fond memories of particularly George, who, when I interviewed both of those guys, it was still a little raw. So they liked talking about that period in their lives because it had a little bit of that amber glow, you know. It's pretty
special.
It's
kind of a perfect, it's kind of a perfect experience, right? They got their great friends. It's the world cares about it. They didn't spend a lot of time on it. It was a big hit, you know, nothing but good feedback.
You can see in the interviews that they're like, they do an interview with like CBC and Rona Barrett and all these, and they're just having the best time. They've got like the cardboard cutout Bob with them because, you know, Bob's not going to come. And there was one interview they did where Bob was like in the kitchen, but he wouldn't come out. I mean, it's just, you know, like if you really dig into the Wilbury stuff, they were just, I think they had more fun promoting that record than anything else, because especially for George, who missed being in a gang, missed being in a band. And then for the other guys, you know, Roy and Jeff Lynne and Tom, to be in a group of equals, peers, and people who get you and you can joke around with, and you've got all your inside jokes and so forth. I think that's sort of priceless, particularly when you've reached that level of success and you're sort of insulated from, you know, it's hard to make friends. And most of the people you play with, band or whatever, no matter how close you are with them, at a certain level, they're employees.
Yeah, that had to apply to Bob too, right? I mean, maybe the reason he was willing to hang around the house and futz around and screw around for, you know, 10 days, because when does Bob get to not, you know, have the world be pulling on him like a magnet? Right. This is the joke everyone repeats from there, that did you know he was a Beatle? Bob knew that all of a sudden I'm not the brightest thing. And even if they're in Dave's house and no one else is around, it's still got to feel really different. You know, I mean, yeah, what do I know? Yeah.
But it's, well, and that was my point earlier, that, you know, certainly they loved Roy so much. That was exciting for him. And he would feel, I think they're all artists have people they look up to. I don't know where he would see himself in, from a competitive standpoint with George. I mean, he's Bob Dylan, but George, the level of success George had had is even as high as Bob went in the mid 60s, they sustained that for 8 years. And even after the band had broken up, it dipped for a bit, but it, you know, by that time it was coming back and, you know, post CDs and so forth. So I think it's got to make it easy for him to sort of just be himself and be in the moment, or easier than, it's probably easier to be in Dave Stewart's house than it is to go to the grocery store, right?
Right. And despite the fact that it wasn't his alone, having a success like that.
Yeah, there's no stakes.
It's got to, you know, feel good, right? So if we pull out and go, you know, Empire Burlesque, you know,
okay, yeah,
Down in the Groove, Knocked Out Loaded, all these things are going on. You know, it's nice to all of a sudden have a big hit and have everyone love it. And then the other thing going on in this whole period is, which is also interesting to talk to you about because of Petty's instrumental role in it, is the transition on the road, right? So Bob, he took a few years off, you know, kind of the Infidels period. There's almost 2 years when he doesn't play. Then he comes back. Live Aid, Farm Aid happen. Now he takes Petty out, does a year, does the Dead shows, and then takes Petty out again. And as you know, we pointed out, we did a Dead show a couple weeks ago. The Petty set list was relatively static on the first tour. And yes, then after the Dead experience, it's all new set every night. And, you know, I think Tom has talked about how fun it was for them to be able to call out songs, you know, and have Bob be willing to do them. So there's that change. Then the Wilburys happens, and now, boom, right, the never-ending tour. This was recorded in May. And whatever it was, June, Lily, they left the Wilburys. So he left the Dave Stewart's house and the tour he had to go on. Actually, I didn't really realize before, the tour he was rushing to get to that made that a deadline was the Net, was the first show of the Net, you know, in Concord.
Yes. So there was a momentum there that I think is interesting to talk about. What I was talking about with regard to being a little bit lost, you know, McCartney and Mick Jagger and, you know, Bob and, you know, a lot of those people who were the 60s generation of rock and rollers, Townsend, you know, it's not that they didn't make some great records. It's not that there weren't songs in there. I mean, McCartney was working with Elvis, right? But the recorded work was a struggle in a way that I think it hadn't been up until 78, 79, 80. It just changed. And for a lot of reasons, not the least of which MTV, and not the least of which the aftermath of punk and what that did to the business. But anybody who thinks that the live shows those guys were doing at that time weren't amazing. I mean, we hadn't gotten to the point where things were so perfected, where the pyro was perfect and the lighting was perfect and computerized and the screens always looked great and everybody wore styled clothes and the stage was just so, and they had their, you know, oriental rug carpets on the, you know, it's like we had yet to get to that level of perfection right? Where it was sort of a going concern, as they say in the business world. I think it was still fairly ramshackle. But when I saw Bob Dylan and Petty, I'm sure it wasn't as good as like when my brother or brother-in-law saw him 10 or 15 or 20 years before. But I thought it was astonishing. You know, there was a section of the set where it was just Bob and his acoustic guitar alone. And there were 20,000 people in the garden completely focused on Bob Dylan. Now, you know, if you hear recordings or whatever, maybe it doesn't sound so great, but it's like when you hear a recording, if you're in the audience and you see
McCartney. Yeah, we all know they, as good as they are, they are not being there at all.
No, and having been there, the magic of that moment was pretty great. And I would argue throughout the 80s, Bob was doing great shows. Some of the shows with the Dead were amazing, but the shows totally. With Petty, I think, you know, everybody agrees were, you know, I've talked to Ben Mon about this. Ben Montench, who played keyboards and was very instrumental in them being able to do any Bob Dylan song because he literally knows them all and he could call it out to the band. They were having the time of their lives doing this. So I think it's sort of related to that Wilburys vibe. They were having fun and the live shows were pretty great. They might be a little ramshackle. There might have been too much booze or whatever going around. But the studio was the issue, you know? It's like, it just wasn't happening. It just was not happening. It's just one last thing. It also was the era when albums typically were only expected to have one or two or three good songs so you could have a video. So if you look at Down in the Groove, it's got a couple of good songs. Even Under the Blood Risk, Under the Risk, you know, it's these records have good songs on them. Knocked Out Loaded, you know, it's got the one good song. But and that was all that record companies kind of cared about. Meanwhile, they were telling these guys, you got to have hits. So if we separate it out and think of these people the way I think Bob Dylan really does as a performer first, that's where he was putting his, you know, putting the money down. And yet you can still find some great songs in there. So look, long before Springtime in New York came about, I had lunch with people from Bob's office and we were arguing about Empire Burlesque. So I came home and I put it on. And if you set aside the 80s production, there's some great songs there. There are songs there.
Completely.
And I said, but that's revisionist. This was like 10 years ago. And I called up and I was like, listen, I'm telling you, we should go through that stuff because there's stuff there. You know, a few years later, I got sent a sort of very early version of Springtime in New York. And I was really excited. You know, there was talk, there were some songs that didn't have Ben Mon and Mike Campbell, maybe bring in Ben Mon and Mike to play some parts, to fill them out. But then they realized the vocal, maybe now with AI, they could do it. But Bob's vocal was, you know, he was off mic, you know, or he was just sort of, the words weren't set, you know, whatever it was. But there was so much material in there. They were able to find, what, it was four or five CDs. It's great. And it totally, It's like, okay, so he was trying to make a hit record because the record company was on his, you know, had their thumb on him. And everybody is susceptible to that, even if you're Bob Dylan. But it wasn't like he was making bad music. There was music there. It just wasn't what maybe the choices that were being made were wrong because it was like, well, I think this is what they want. I don't know, but I'm guessing because every artist goes through that. There's a period in your life when you go through.
Yeah. No, look, I'm a fan of all of that. First of all, that's the period when I kind of started, right? You know,
he was on MTV. I'm like, oh my God, it's Bob Dylan.
Infidels and Empire Burlesque were the only two albums I probably had for 10 or more years. I loved them, but didn't expand. I just thought these are great. And, you know, maybe I heard a little bit, but I also think the interesting thing about the Springtime in New York stuff, which and we had a show about this a few weeks ago, is first of all, if you listen now in high res, I think Empire Burlesque sounds fantastic. All those parts, you know, and maybe just have better equipment than I had back then, but they're crisp and great. And I don't blame Arthur, you know, Baker or feel bad about any of that at all. And second of all, you can construct the pre-Arthur Baker version now with all those other tracks.
Yes.
And you probably, if you had those two in front of you, I think you'd put out the one they put out, because it's kind of...
It's a little dull.
It's just another dull, right? It's a Bob thing, and that stuff is cool. And I'll also and send
I mean
you...
Dull, I don't mean dull interesting. I mean dull sonic.
Right. Yeah. Right. It's just not as distinctive. And if you see that they were trying to get on the radio, you see why they did it, but also I don't... Anyway, there's no apologies about it here at all.
It's 45 years ago. It doesn't matter.
Right. Well, I'll also send you, just because for fun, as part of the series, I made a compilation playlist of these three albums. But you were talking about there's good songs on each of them.
Yeah.
So I made an album called Empire of the Loaded Groove that is...
There you go.
10 songs out of the three of them. And I've been listening to it all the time since I made it. It's just, you know, phenomenal. So the question buried in that original thing was, and first of all, I'm really glad you made the distinction between live and studio, because it was part of the point of doing this series was to look back and say, there's a ton of good in this period that gets cartooned as bad. And the live is one of them. The Wilburys are one of them. You know, the Petty Tours are one of them. The Farm Aid or whatever. There's lots of things. You know, the Letterman show, the original Plugs thing is in here, is that taking Tom and the Heartbreakers out and having that kind of fun and him feeling different was part of this experimentation that in 88, he said, okay, I'm going to reinvent myself by being on the road. I'm going to go do the Neverending Tour. And it's a building block to what happened, even if besides being good and interesting, you know, he got a lot out of it and he clearly enjoyed it. It was, you know, the coincidence of whatever, you know, happened to him and the Dead and the smoke in a jazz club in San Rafael thing.
It's a great story.
I was talking to Erin Callahan, and I talked for an episode that we haven't played yet. And she is looking at the 80s and has this phrase that I think she got from someone who I wouldn't know to name about allowing our great artists to struggle and say, okay, you know, that's what's going to happen. And it's fun for us to, you know, it's not sad. It's not going to be bad. We get to watch. And so, you know, we got a bunch of albums. We got the Petty Tour. We got the Dead Tour. And then to me, this Wilburys thing is just this cool cherry in the middle of it all.
It is. You know? Yeah, totally agree.
Well, let's talk about your record for a few minutes.
Sure.
I because you're a Costello fan, I know you won't mind that I almost said the other side of summer a minute ago, but it's the last days of summer.
Last day, but yes.
The last day of summer, which I've been listening to for a few weeks.
Come on, Jim Keltner, and that's a hot song, man. I love that song. You know,
with a gun to my head, that may be my favorite Elvis album. I love everything about it, and the beard years, and the fact that song wasn't a hit. You put someone else's name. That was like an Elvis thing. You put someone else's name on that song and put it out. Anyway.
Yeah.
So you've got a new album full of guest stars and full of what I think is a slightly new sound for Jeff Slate. Which I love. We were talking about before. Tell me a little about the record and who's on it, and we'll squeeze a track in here when I
sure. Well, the first single, which is coming out now, or is out by the time people hear this, is "Broken Without You," which was co-produced by Dave Stewart. It was a song that, you know, in any batch of songs you record in the studio. And these were songs that were largely written toward the tail end of the pandemic, when we were all still tail end of being in lockdown. Because at the time in 2020, Earl Slick and I were going to go on a tour. So we were going to make a record and then put out a record so we'd have something for this tour. And I thought, since I was sitting at home with literally nothing to do a lot of the time, I would write. And, you know, sometimes you just hit a groove. And so I had what I felt was a really healthy batch of songs that showed my influences, but had my own style and also were a little bit more, maybe more mature than songs I had written previously, which felt good. I'm not a young guy. And I think that's part of the, you know, letting go of trying to, you know, write a hit song or a song that fits in with what people listen to. And so, but I had this one song that I liked enough that I didn't want to drop it, but I just couldn't get it right. And I happened to be on the phone with Dave Stewart, as you do, And he, you know, he's like, hey, what are you working on? Blah, blah, blah. And I told him, and he said, oh, he was at his studio on a remote island in the Atlantic. So, you know how it is. And
as you do.
He said, as you do. And he said, you know, send me the tracks and I'll see what I can do with it. And he goes, it's funny, but it's like you said, if you put the two versions next to each other, they're both available on the album. You know, some people maybe won't hear the difference, but I did immediately because he stripped it down and built it back up. He added some guitar, you know, himself, very sort of ambient and some twangy, you know, that Strat sound he has. But he made it less cluttered. You know, I mean, this is a guy who obviously knows how to make a hit record. Now, I didn't think he was going to make a hit record out of this, but and it's not by any means my favorite song off the album, but when I started playing it for people, they got really excited about it. Now, first of all, I think people get excited when you say Dave Stewart had something to do with it. Certainly the guy who owns my label did, but I think also he did do something that I don't know what it is. It's that magic that happens when somebody else, you know, puts their stamp on it. So that was pretty exciting. And I suppose in some ways he's the biggest maybe name on the record. Duff McKagan plays bass. Ron Blair from the Heartbreakers plays bass. Earl Slick is, I think, on every track. Don Miguel, who helmed the last couple of Leonard Cohen records, plays a bunch of guitar. A couple of the guys from Noel Gallagher's band and female vocalist from Noel Gallagher's band. YC from his band sings the French section, which he wrote on the Dave Stewart track. People from Paul Weller's band, Noel Gallagher's band. I guess I said Duff. I guess I said Ron Blair. Lee Harris from Saucer Full of Secrets. You know, it's sort of, these are the guys I know who were not doing anything in 20, 21, and 22 because they couldn't yet or whenever.
So was it a lot of remote parts that you assembled?
It was. And you know, somebody was asking me about this earlier and we over-tracked because when you record that way, it's very hard to know how the puzzle pieces fit together when you're doing it long distance. And then I, rather than try to make sense of it myself and have it be a cluttered mess, I sent it to this guy, Dwayne Lundy, and who has worked with Willie Nelson and Ringo, and he's, you know, mixes for big deal people, but he's a buddy of mine. And he was really committed to making this record sound as good as it could sound. In other words, he had heard previous records like you and would say to me, oh, I know what I would do. Right. And so that means he's hearing something different in his head. And I thought, well, let him do that. That's why I had a producer work with me on this record. I wanted somebody to say, you can come up with something better, or that's great. You know, because a lot of times you don't know in the moment which it is, you know? So it was a very different experience. You know, the record's been done quite a long time now, but even once we got out of the pandemic to get sort of on the release schedule, everything was backed up because people had all these records that, so it was going to, I think it was going to be at one point, you know, last summer, and then it was going to be last fall. And then it was like, look, let's just wait until after Christmas because everybody was putting out a record in the fall and we'll put it out in May and we'll do a couple of singles and get people warmed up for it. And it's been, you know, it's very exciting. The people who've heard it so far, like you've been really into it, really excited about it. And I have to say, you know, it's, there's something different about making a record in your 50s than in your 20s, where you kind of don't give a fuck. I mean, you just like, it's just, this is the best I can do right now. And I'm happy with the results, like genuinely happy with the results. Whereas, you know, when you're making records early in a career, you're trying to be something or do something, you know, be somebody you're not, or do something you're not really maybe capable of doing. You want to be Bob Dylan, you want to be Bruce Springsteen, you want to be the Beatles or the Small Faces or whoever it is. And at a certain point, you know, when people come to your shows and like your music or whatever, you're like, well, I'm just going to give them the best thing I can do right now. And I think that goes back to what we were talking about with regard to those guys finding their way by the end of the 80s into the 90s and 2000s.
Well, it's a great sounding record, and it's almost amazing to think it was assembled from, you know, from parts, because it's so cohesive. And I know that's how it's done. But, you know, as I said to you, it really has some of it was done
in a room, but a lot of it was tracked. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a great cohesive sound. And I don't know if my version's a little different, but there are a lot of these bonus tracks and alt versions on it. Anyway, well, we'll put links and people can go check it out. Are you going to go play some live shows or just here in the city or anything?
Yeah. I mean, no. That is absolutely the plan, that, you know, we're going to kind of gear up in the spring. There's a couple of TV things we might do. And then in May, June, July, play pretty much everywhere. We're looking at playing the UK and Europe and doing a bunch of stuff here. But, you know, I mean, obviously anybody who's in the Northeast can see me whenever they want. I play pretty regularly. And I think that's going to go into 2025 because, there are a lot of things we had scheduled last year, like playing in Tulsa or playing in Gainesville or things like that, which were sort of planned because a record was going to be out. And then once it wasn't, well, I don't know that we can do that again this year. We might have to wait till 25 to go back to those places. So, you know, a lot of that's to be determined. So it's not like the old days where you put out a record and you tour for 6 months. It's like you're going to work a record for a good long time while you work on the next one. So, yeah.
Right. All right, cool. Well, as we mentioned before, you also do these, you know, and you say, here we're lucky in New York, so you do these tribute kind of shows. And we retweet it all the time. You're doing a Wilbury show, you're doing a Petty show, you do Dylan shows, which I've seen several of. So people have plenty of chances. Anyway, yeah. Jeff, thanks for sharing your wealth of Wilbury knowledge.
We didn't even scratch the surface.
I know. Well, I think there's a documentary movie needs to be made to do this really right. But
I would love to do it, but I think it's a story that's, you know, it's in pieces in the Jeff Lynne documentary, in the Tom Petty documentary, in the George documentary, and then there is that Wilbury's sort of short film.
Do you have that big?
Yeah, the Genesis Publications book. Yeah.
I've never ponied up, but I see it around once in a while.
I would pick it up. I think it's stuff you can find elsewhere. I don't know that it's. It's nice to have everything in one place and it's nice to have the photographs and so forth.
Yeah.
But it isn't one of my favorite Genesis books. And I do love those Genesis books. So,
yeah.
But you know, take a look at it. It's not super expensive either. And it's signed, you know, my regret is that I didn't have Tom sign it because I thought about bringing it with me one time when he was in town. You only have Jeff on it. It's like, you know, I kind of want George. Yeah. I kind of want Roy.
Yeah. Asking for autographs is, I think, always better not done. But it would be cool to have.
Getting it is not good, but
having it is cool.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like I wish it was signed by George. Just because, I mean, I have a couple of his Genesis books and Derek Taylor's Genesis book, which are signed by him, and it makes it cool. His Live in Japan book, you know, it's like you can't read that story anywhere else. You can't see those photos anywhere else. And it's signed by George and comes with used guitar picks and the whole thing. I'm like, sign me up, man. I'm a sucker.
It's kind of amazing how, I mean, I guess it was because it was George and his label, but the Wilburys really had an amazing marketing push behind them. You know, the interview stuff you talked about, the videos, that movie they made, the book. You know, for a side project, that's a lot of horsepower.
I think it was maybe the last gasp of a particular era of people, you know, Moe Austin in particular, who loved George and loved those guys. I mean, George sued him and he still loved him. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, it's very, very Ruddles-esque. But, you know, I think they couldn't help but make money on something like that, you know?
Yeah.
So
I saw an interview yesterday and I don't think it's one of the main ones where George says, well, you know, you get the four of us and you figure you're going to sell 400,000 or 500,000, even if it's no good, but it turned out to be good.
I don't know what it sold, but what do you think about the numbers, George? They didn't suck.
Yeah. It was just like, you know, for George, a bad record's, you know, 400,000.
Yeah.
So
anyway,
Jeff, thanks very much. This was great. And congratulations on the new record. And we will talk again.
Great. Appreciate it.
I'm gonna love you under New York City skies. Cause all the to and fro, it makes me feel alive. I'm gonna love you till New York City dies. There is no question in my mind. The premises make well enough. I can't reach you, no, I can't reach you. Of course, maybe I don't deserve to. I'm gonna love you till New York City dies. I'm gonna love you under New York City skies. Cause off to and fro, it makes me feel alive. I'm gonna love you till New York City dies. I play the victim too many times. I tell the bitter and I believe my own lies. And I can't reach you, no, I can't reach you. Of course, maybe I don't deserve to. I'm gonna love you till New York City dies. I'm gonna love you under New York City skies. Off to and fro, it makes me feel alive. I'm gonna love you till New York City dies. Step inside the circle, say my name. I'm holding on to nothing with no one but myself to blame. City skies. Cause off to and fro, it makes me feel alive. I'm gonna love you till New York City dies. Yeah, I'm gonna love you till New York City dies. I'm gonna love you under New York City skies. Cause off to and fro, it makes me feel alive.
Did you enjoy this show? Then please rate this podcast and leave a review. It really helps. And take a moment to follow this podcast so you don't miss upcoming episodes. Thanks for listening.